The Undivided Podcast is brought to you by 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com. Today, a Chehalis bar and restaurant has its liquor license revoked and its alcohol confiscated for violating COVID-19 mandates.
I have to hold myself accountable for what the choices I made, but I stand by those choices.
Plus, as her time in office comes to a close, Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan talks about her legacy.
When history looks back at this moment, do you believe you'll have struck the right balance between life and liberty?
Absolutely.
And finally, Washington Governor Jay Inslee outlines his plan for dealing with the state's homeless crisis. Yet one key component seems to be missing. Thank you so much for joining us on the Undivided Podcast. I'm Brandi Cruz. It's no secret that since the beginning of the pandemic, some businesses have been violating COVID mandates and have done so knowingly, knowing that violation of those mandates could lead to punishments from the state. Now, in a lot of cases, businesses end up relenting and changing their ways and enforcing the mandates because they don't want to lose their business, frankly, and the state has a lot of power in that regard. But this morning, I saw something that caught my attention. The Chronicle, which is a news agency out of Centralia, had a reporter doing a live stream from Mackinac's and the Curious Bar in Chehalis. And their live stream showed two agents with the state liquor and cannabis board seizing bottles of alcohol from this bar as customers and the owner and employees look on.
You're going to feel disgusting as a person. A year from now when there's no f***ing masks, are you going to feel disgusting? You should.
And I did some digging into what was going on here because the scene is pretty extraordinary. And it turns out that Mackinac's and the Curious Bar have been the subject of several actions from the Washington State Liquor and Cannabis Board going back to December of 2020 when they were accused of allowing indoor dining at a time when indoor dining was prohibited. And it ultimately wound up with an order being issued that their liquor license would be permanently revoked effective 10 a.m. today, December 17th. And so this video is two agents with the Liquor and Cannabis Board executing that order. Now, the reason I found all this pretty extraordinary is, one, the scene. Just seeing these agents go in and bottle by bottle take out all of this establishment's alcohol. But second, I don't believe I've ever seen, at least play out in real time, this serious of an action against a business for violating COVID mandates. Because, you know, like I said, the interactions between this business and the Washington State Liquor and Cannabis Board go back to December of 2020, and often you see some sort of resolution before then, but this business would not waver, would not enforce any of the mandates coming down from the governor, and as a result, has lost arguably something that's critical to having a bar and restaurant, a liquor license. So I called up Mackinac's and I spoke to the owner, a woman named Chef Laurel Kahn, who talked about why she felt so strongly about not following the COVID mandates. The obvious question is, tell me what happened this morning around 10 a.m.
We were notified a few weeks back that they would be pulling the license on the 17th. We exhausted all the appeals. We started the process, or I started it. Then I got enlisted an attorney toward fall. So they came by and said that they'll be coming and this is what to expect. And you're to take all the alcohol off, anything left they'll be taking. Then there's a procedure that I can dump or I can keep as my own personal and then I pay taxes on it.
In the video that I saw, the live stream of this, there were a lot of other people there at the time. Were these customers or supporters?
Customers and family customers, yes.
So what does this mean in theory for your business?
I'm like one of the top 10 restaurants in Washington State. I mean, for a restaurant at this level, not to have wine, not with your steak. I mean, I could probably limp along for a few months, but no, I can't run a restaurant without a liquor license, but there's silver lining. Not that I've figured it all out yet, but I will figure it out. And for instance, tonight I have a full restaurant in the next 2 days. And Mackinac is an incredible environment. I mean, I've had it for 15 years. My customer base, the support I've got throughout the state, but especially this area, has been immense. And it's like what I did during COVID is I said, nope, we're staying normal. And we just remain normal. So people come here and be normal. And tonight it will be the same thing. They're going to come and they're going to feel like they've always been here in Mackinac or Curious. And we will, the whole evening will be hosted. And there will be no money exchanged, but they will be able to have their dinner that they expected, their holiday parties, and it will just go on as usual.
On the restaurant side, you can still operate as a restaurant. You just can't serve booze. Am I understanding that correctly?
Right.
And so then on the bar side, what becomes of it? Because if you can't serve booze at a bar, I don't.
It would probably not be very busy.
The obvious question that people are going to have is, why would you be willing to risk everything that happened today over the COVID mandates? Why not just follow them and keep your liquor license?
I've always been that person that fought the battles. I always saw the bigger picture. At 4, my uncle was shot down in Vietnam. As a young girl, I learned that there's more to this world than my little teeny world there. So when the governor did what he did in March, I said, no, anytime there's fear put in the people, that's not the way government should operate. So I stood by what I believed. It's integrity over money, so be it.
And you said there, you've always been the kind of person to try to focus on the bigger picture. So if you're focusing on the bigger picture, the bigger fight, what is that bigger picture for you?
You know, I, being a political science major, I do believe in the process. And as a young person, I was a community organizer and I went back to go into political science because I realized you have to kind of be on the inside to make some changes. Boy, it's tough. I mean, but I feel that I have a voice and I would like my voice to be out there. I have a kind of a plan on where I'm going forward with this. And I have, as a business person, I understand how we can make changes in our government. So I'm going to be a part of those changes or work toward that.
Can you tell me how?
I'm going to actually run for governor.
You are in 2024?
Yes.
Well,
is actually my official announcement. I put my first paperwork in, so now I have 2 weeks to get my financial little paperwork done.
You know, there are going to be people, though, who will push back on you, and I'm already seeing it on social media. There are businesses across the state who have, at great personal sacrifice, followed the mandates and been able to survive. And so what do you say to all those businesses who did what was asked of them and who've struggled as a result?
You know, and that is a part of the question. I chose to do something because I had to get strength for the community. And I went and I spent time at businesses and I was always out there just trying to keep us strong and keeping us the fear at a minimal. And by doing that, I was able to have people in who wanted to be here, and we were able to keep strong and keep our mental health. And I wish, and I tried to get other businesses to follow what I was doing. If I would have been mayor, our whole city would have been doing something differently. So I did what I did. They did what they did. I support both ways. I think the divide and conquer is tremendously harmful right now. And I mean, it's sorrowful. The people I've lost as friends because of what I stood for. But that's the price you pay. And I'm paying the price. And I have to hold myself accountable for what the choices I made. But I stand by those choices.
And you acknowledge that, you know, going back to December 2020, which is the first time that really the Liquor and Cannabis Board had contact with you, you acknowledge that you've been violating the rules that the governor set forth.
Yes.
There's no disagreement there.
No. My attorney said, the problem is you're too honest. It's like, well, that's me.
Now, I've got to call out two things. I don't know how much you know about this show, but it's really about trying to bring reason and common sense back to the news, back to politics. There's two things I saw on the live stream this morning that I didn't agree with. One of them is the swastika, just because I hate Nazi comparisons. So I don't know who the man was the sign with the swastika. But I don't know if it was employees or who it was. The two officers that came in, they weren't treated wonderfully.
No.
Is going to be the argument that, hey, they're just doing their job, that they didn't put this mandate down. Do you feel for them at all?
Oh, definitely. I mean, Steve is one of the taller one. He's been the one coming in every time. And he always says, God, I love coming to see you. I mean, I don't like what I have to do when I see you, but, you know, I'm always, we just have fun. I mean, we joke. I mean, I probably joke too much, but when they came and we had to go to another part of the restaurant to take some alcohol, I just said, you know, I just told them, I go, you guys, I know you're doing your job. And I know it's a bureaucratic job. And I just hope someday you have a job in the private sector where it won't feel like this. And I've had discussions with the younger one, Steve, before, just saying, you know, this is going to affect you someday, but it's okay. I'm okay. You know, it'll be okay. You know, his passion is wrestling, but he has a family, and he took this job because to make ends meet. And it's a hard thing. Our bureaucracy has issues. I've worked in other states. I've had own businesses in Chicago, a business in Chicago, and working with that bureaucracy was wonderful. So it can be different.
Let's end with this. What would your message be to Governor Jay Inslee if he's listening?
I wish that he could have come to dinner at my restaurant and there could have been a human aspect to what was going on, to have a discussion. I had no idea that COVID violations would come to this. I mean, I've never had a liquor violation. It's just so, and I didn't know that four strikes and you're out. I mean, so there's things that are on my fault, but I would have loved to have a human interaction with him and just have a discussion, because I think I could bring something to the table.
So there you have it. Chef Laurel Kahn, the owner of Mackinac's and the Curious Bar in Chehalis, Washington, on the same day her liquor license is revoked by the state, says she is going to run for the governor of Washington, inspired by her disagreement with how Governor Jay Inslee has handled the pandemic. And as I, you know, alluded to in the interest of what this podcast is all about, as I alluded to Chef Kahn, don't agree with the customer, whoever that was, holding up a big sign with a swastika. I hate Nazi comparisons. Again, if you're using a Nazi comparison, you need to work harder on your arguments. And two, I was disappointed to see how the agents with the Liquor and Cannabis Board were treated. At the end of the day, they're trying to keep their jobs, trying to feed their families. I can't fault anyone for that. I am sure that there are people who are going to disagree, given the fact that those actions might have cost some people at this bar and restaurant their livelihoods. But remember who these mandates come from. They come from Governor Jay Inslee. And there are thousands and thousands of state workers down the chain who have to enforce these mandates in one way or another, even if they don't agree with them. So just keep that in mind. For those who follow Seattle politics, or even if you don't, Seattle has been at the center of a lot of national stories over the past couple of years. Of course, our area was the first hit by the pandemic in the United States. There was a lot of unrest here following the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. We were at the center of the debate over police defunding. We had Chaz Chop, the autonomous zone that encompassed six square blocks of the city and rendered an entire police precinct useless. So let's just say that Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan, in her first and only term in office, has had a lot to contend with. I think that's fair to say, and perhaps that's why she opted not to run for a second term. But regardless, she and we've spoke many times during the pandemic. I had a regular standing interview with the mayor over the past almost 2 years, and now her time in office is coming to a close. And so I sat down with the mayor at City Hall, and we reflected on her legacy and how she has handled some of the most challenging issues that have come her way. And my first question for the mayor was simple. Do you believe that Seattle is better off today than it was when you took office?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, and it's not just my leadership, it's working together with the people in the city across industries, collaborations with business, with King County, with the state. I think the city's much better off.
You think there's probably some places where it's not better off?
Better off from what it could have been, or better off from where we are? Because we can't ignore the fact that the pandemic disrupted everything in this city and in our country. And there was life, you know, before COVID, BC, and then life during COVID. And unfortunately, we're still in that life. And so having to respond to a crisis of the proportion eclipses everything else. And I'm really proud that I and the city were able to move forward on critical programs, even during the pandemic, that really enhanced our opportunity as a city to recover and recover well.
When I look at, though, issues like homelessness, street crime, police staffing. Those have all gotten worse. Could we agree?
I think that we've got incredible challenges there. And there's no question that both the pandemic and the events of the, you know, disagreements between myself and the council added to that. But I also think if you look at some of the fundamental things we've done, even in this last year, we've made progress on those. We've stood up a regional homeless authority, first in our region, that really can be the framework for making progress there. Working with Chief Diaz, we are going to do everything we can to increase the number of officers. And I've talked to incoming Mayor-elect Harrell. It's his priority. We know we need more police officers. We've stood up alternatives to policing that can work with police officers and take some of the things like crisis intervention off their plate. And on homelessness, by the end of the year, because we pushed on getting more shelter, we'll clear the largest encampments, Broadview Thompson, Ballard Commons, Chinatown International District, and hopefully Green Lake. So we are really trying to make progress so that the city can start a fresh start in January.
On the pandemic, this sounds like a cold way to ask this question, but do you feel like your term was robbed in a way by the pandemic, that you couldn't do all the things and focus on all the things you wanted to do because of that crisis?
I would frame it differently. I think history calls people to do things. And at this moment in history, we had to have leaders that would stand up to lead and really focus on the science and challenge across the board both the health impacts and the economic impacts. And we've seen it throughout the history of the world that there are those moments. And, you know, I there's the old quote that says, you know, you are called to the destiny you're given, not the one you want. And we as a city, if you look, we were the first in Brandy. And because of the steps we took and were very intentional and worked really hard to bring people along, to work across governments, to work with the healthcare industry and private business, today Seattle has the lowest incidence of COVID cases, hospitalizations, and mortality rate. That's a remarkable accomplishment. It doesn't at all undermine the fact that a lot of people have suffered. That is just as true. But as a city, I think we came through that as well as we could because we pulled together and focused on our common interest.
But we still, as a city, have some of the strictest mandates in place in the country and as a state. And I kind of wonder why, you know, I don't know if you saw what Colorado Governor Jared Polis, a Democrat, said. He said that with the availability of the vaccines to adults and children, he considers the medical crisis emergency to be over. He said at this point, if you're unvaccinated, that's your own darn fault if you go to the hospital. Do you agree with that mindset?
No, I think the virus has shown that that's not been true at any stage for people to declare it's over. You know, we just saw this week that Cornell University went from almost zero cases to 900 cases in a matter of days, and they closed their whole campus. Omicron's real. We don't know how dangerous it is yet, but we do know it is much more transmissible, that if you are vaccinated and not boosted, you may be more susceptible, it may be less severe. And so we are still in the throes of having the last stages of what this virus will do before it gets to the place where it's one of the things we deal with on an annual basis like we do with the flu.
What is that place, though? When is that time? What is the benchmark?
I think the benchmark is, if you look historically, and I'm not a virologist, although I feel like I could play one on TV now. I've spent so much time with them. You know, there is a scientific growth. And over time, one thing people are hoping about Omicron is it is more virulent and maybe less serious. But because it's more virulent, it could eclipse Delta, which has things. And that's what happens in the course of a virus. But we don't know yet because the Southern Hemisphere is still creating so many mutations because there's so few vaccinations there and they're at higher risk. And so we don't know. No one can predict with certainty what will happen with this virus. And I think it's foolish for people to pretend they can.
You know, you and I have talked many times during the pandemic, I think over 50, because for some reason you kept doing interviews with me every week, which I don't know why. We do get along, though.
That's
get along
fun. See, it shows you, though, I thought it was super important during the pandemic because people were sheltered at home to be as transparent as possible and talk as much as you could to members of the media so that people could get information firsthand on an ongoing basis.
I give you credit for that. Because we had some interviews that weren't necessarily pleasant, but we'd still, you know, do want
to
get in the following
week. You've got to be willing.
Is,
that's part of government's job, in my view, is You have to let people ask the questions. Because otherwise all you breed is distrust.
One of the questions I asked you towards the beginning of the pandemic was how you strike the right balance between preserving life and protecting liberty. And at the time you thought that that balance was being struck and was appropriate. When history looks back at this moment, do you believe you'll have struck the right balance between life and liberty?
Absolutely. And I think that right now we're in a phase two. It's like you've just indicated, is every step of the way, individual choice has played a role. And people can stand up and do what the science tells them will protect them and their families and their coworkers, or they can't. And I'm really fortunate because I happen to be the mayor of a city where people made the decision to take those steps that they thought would help themselves, their families, and their coworkers.
But sometimes those decisions were, I don't know if I would call them a choice. I mean, they were very difficult for people to make, like facing the loss of their job. And I don't know if I'm faced with the loss of my income for my family, whether I call that a personal choice. You know, for the last about a month and a half, I was every week, are you going to fire unvaccinated officers? Are you going to fire unvaccinated officers? And you just wouldn't answer the question directly. And now that we're there, is there a reason? Is there a reason?
Yeah, the flip is also true. Are those officers going to get vaccinated? There is free choice and free will. And I think the real story is over 90%, I think we're close to 94, 95% of officers made that decision. And so the real question is, why did they do it and the others didn't? And why are the ones that held out, was that the right choice for them and their families? That's their decision, but clearly would not have been the right choice for their coworkers or the public they serve. And when you're in the position that you're serving the public on the front lines, you do have to make choices that are part of that job.
And you can watch more of my conversation with Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan coming up this Sunday, exclusively for subscribers. If you'd like to subscribe to Undivided, you can do so at patreon.com/undivided. That's patreon.com/undivided. Or I've also launched a locals community. You can find it at brandycruz.locals.com. A topic I want to cover today that I'm going to discuss in greater detail on the Undivided Digital Show on Sunday is Governor Jay Inslee's plan to deal with the state's homeless crisis. And look, it's not just Washington State. You have other states, including Oregon and California, that are dealing with homelessness in a very serious way. And it's a problem that has become increasingly bad, really across the West Coast. And in Washington State, there's no question. You go downtown Seattle, it is very evident how bad our homeless crisis is. Now, I was happy to see that in looking ahead to the next budget debate in Olympia, Governor Jay Inslee is prioritizing homelessness in his 2022 policy rollout. And that's a good step, right? You want to recognize that we do have a crisis and we need to address it. Honestly, it should be the single biggest thing that lawmakers in Olympia are dealing with right now. But then I looked at the governor's plan for dealing with homelessness. And not surprisingly, it centers on affordable housing. So just the 5-point plan, pursue new avenues to help people remain in their homes. And that is a no-brainer, right? If you can keep people from falling into homelessness, if they're on the cusp, it's way cheaper and less hurtful for people if you can do that on the front end rather than having to try to get them out of homelessness on the back end. So that seems non-controversial to me. And then you get into the other four categories here. Secure more facilities to provide permanent, supportive, and affordable housing. Transition encamped people to permanent housing solutions. Restore the range of affordable housing types in our cities. And finally, expand supportive services for people with behavioral health needs. And then the governor wrote this massive article on Medium laying out the plan in detail. And in this entire article, the issue of drug use is only mentioned one time. You have this entire plan from the governor, which would cost $800 million. And there is almost no mention of arguably, not even arguably, factually, one of the key driving forces of the state's homeless epidemic. And that is drug addiction. Any person can walk 3 blocks in downtown Seattle and realize that the root cause of our homeless crisis is drug addiction and mental health. Now, the governor talks about what they're calling behavioral health, and they're lumping mental health and substance abuse into that. But the vast majority of the money that the governor is putting forward in $800 million of spending is for housing. Only $48 million of $800 million, $48 million out of $800 million is for behavioral health services. How do you solve a crisis if you're not even willing to admit what the crisis is? Either they're willfully ignoring it or they're really that incompetent. I don't actually know what would be worse. And this isn't just coming from a talking head. This is coming from someone whose father died drug addicted, alcoholic, and homeless. Drugs and alcoholism killed my dad. Drugs and alcoholism led to a life of homelessness. That's why he died in a cheap motel room. If you're not willing to acknowledge the problem, you're never going to fix it. You cannot put someone who's drug addicted or mentally ill into an apartment and expect that they're going to be able to live a normal life. You cannot look at the streets of Seattle and say the cause of our homeless crisis is a majority because of income inequality. You don't just fall from, oh, I can't afford this apartment and I'm living a totally normal life, into shooting up heroin on the sidewalk at 3rd and Pine. We have to be honest about that. That does not happen. And the governor is talking about, you know, the great work of Dow Constantine, the King County executive, and he's talking about the next mayor of Seattle, Bruce Harrell. Look, Dow Constantine is entering his fourth term, and all of a sudden he's been buying up a bunch of hotels because he has money that came from the federal government due to the COVID pandemic, and everybody wants to act like he is the region's savior on homelessness. That man has been in office for 12 years, and the homeless crisis has not improved. It has drastically worsened. That is one of the people the governor is lifting up as being able to help get us out of this crisis is deeply concerning. And Mayor-elect Bruce Harrell, I mean, maybe he'll be able to do more in the mayor's office. I sure hope so. But keep in mind, he was in city government for a long time, and he was the city council president during a period of time where this crisis was getting worse and worse. I wish nothing but the best for elected leaders when it comes to dealing with this crisis. I don't want them to fail. None of us should want them to fail. But if you cannot be brutally honest about the unfortunate reality facing a lot of people who are living on the streets, I just don't have a lot of hope in any plan that you put forward. I don't care if the governor spends $800 million or $800 billion. Money is not a solution to a problem. Ideas are a solution. This state is not short on cash. If money were a solution to a problem, we would have no problems. What we're short on are good ideas and honesty about what the problem truly is. And I am honestly begging elected leaders to be more forthcoming. And I don't know if the issue is they don't want to offend people, they don't want to label people, they don't want to pretend like everyone living on the streets is a drug addict. No one is saying that everyone living on the streets is a drug addict. But again, you take a walk through downtown Seattle and you will see with your own eyes that many of them are. And it doesn't help any of them by ignoring the reason that they're living on the streets. Maybe it helps politicians feel like they're better people for not pointing that out. And, oh, this is just because this person can't afford a $1,200, $1,400, $1,600 a month apartment in Belltown. That is not the issue here. And when I talk about reason and common sense, the lack of those two things are really what's to blame for the state of our homeless crisis, not only in Washington, but beyond. Thank you so much for joining us on the Undivided Podcast. It is brought to you by 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com. And I want to take a moment here at the end of the podcast to thank one of my generous subscribers. Aaron Rich has been an Undivided subscriber from the beginning. He's actually a friend of mine who's been really supportive of a lot of my endeavors. And this is something I'm going to be doing on the podcast every single week. And that is just thanking those of you who have stepped up and said, I support what Brandy's doing. I support the content. I want her to continue to grow it. It means the world to me. I could not do this without you. So thank you, thank you, thank you, Aaron Rich, for being an Undivided subscriber.